coming. So welcome to everybody. I'm Jeff Schullenberger. I'm managing editor of Compact Magazine. And over on my left is my colleague Nina Power, who is senior editor, also at Compact. And just to my left is our special guest, Professor Avital Ronell. For those who might be unfamiliar or need a refresher, Compact is an online magazine founded in 2022. In fact, the launch party was for the magazine was roughly 2 years ago in this same bar, although upstairs. So it's kind of coming full circle here. And Compact seeks a new political center devoted to the common good, believing that political forces, not economic ones, should determine our common life. We draw on the social democratic tradition to argue for an order marked by authentic freedom, social stability, and shared prosperity. So the Blame Theory podcast is one of several new initiatives Compact is launching as we enter a third year as a magazine. Others include a new Substack newsletter, which you can find at compactmag.substack.com, as well as an expansion of our reporting by writers, especially from the Global South, from countries that are often not widely covered in Anglophone media. So those are just a few things that we're really committing to expanding this year. And this podcast is also kind of part of this relaunch and expansion that we're undertaking at the moment. So the aim of Blame Theory, briefly, is to take a seriously playful look at the ideas that have shaped our minds and our world, to ask, how have we ended up here? And whom or what can we blame? Plato, Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche, nominalism, Gnosticism, feminism, postmodernism, critical theory, Milton Friedman. These are just some possibilities we will explore. So the origin of this podcast concept was looking at the narratives that are out there in which various theories and theorists are blamed for all manner of things. Nina will be helping us delve into some examples of this phenomenon in a minute. But the goal is to explore these types of narratives, both seriously and playfully, as the description just suggested, and open-endedly as well, as I hope we'll try to exemplify tonight. So the topic for our first episode is blame deconstruction, and again, as Nina will get into, I think this is one of the most widely circulated blame narratives that you can find out there. And our special guest is Avital Ronell, who is a professor down the street at NYU, University Professor of German and Comparative Literature, and also holds the Jacques Derrida Chair and is Professor of Philosophy at the European Graduate School. She's somebody who was there when it was all going down with deconstruction. So she's really an ideal person to talk about deconstruction, talk about the stories about it with. And we're so glad that she was willing to join us. Just a few further remarks about Avital. She's the author of more books than I would have time to list. To name a few, The Telephone Book, Crack Wars, Stupidity, Loser Sons, and Complaint. So I think these titles are exemplary of her style of thinking. And her work, as I think these titles indicate, often takes as a starting point something that might be regarded as too peripheral, too trivial, or indeed too stupid to really be regarded as a serious object of philosophical inquiry, and to trouble those assumptions, to call that those premises into question, but also the premise that we can separate something like serious inquiry from something that would presumably have to be unserious inquiry. So that, I think, is, I hope, a reasonably accurate kind of overview of what I've found compelling in her thought, at least. And she's also someone who writes and speaks with exceptional humor and verve. So thanks so much, Avital.
Thank you, everyone.
And I think we're going to dig now into the meat, which is blaming deconstruction. And as I said, Nina has a few examples to get us started, just to kind of give us a sense of these types of narratives that have emerged around it.
Right, yeah, thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Avital, for agreeing to come. And yeah, so I guess part of the premise for the whole podcast is basically we're probably quite used to this idea where people are maybe making a shortcut in intellectual history and saying, like, it's all somebody's fault, or it's all, you know, this particular way of thinking's fault. So I went and had a look at where people had used the phrase blame deconstruction on Twitter. And I guess before we get to that, it's obvious that people still use deconstruction synonymously with destruction and see it as something kind of fundamentally like tearing stuff down, and we have to like bear that popular use in mind. But I got some choice quotes, because there are definitely those who would blame deconstruction, however they understand it, for the kind of collapse of all that is good and meaningful and beautiful and true. So here are some samples. Deconstruction allows people to spout whatever they feel about everything in all caps, because there is no meaning. I blame deconstruction for the rise of Trumpism. It gave college students an excuse not to do their homework, leading to the multi-generational crescendo of deep ignorance and stupidity that now pervades the American electorate. Interesting side note, there is an ongoing debate in various parts of Christianity about deconstruction at the moment, where deconstruction is wreaking havoc among various belief systems in Christianity. Maybe we'll return to this. There was a long piece in the National Review in 2020 by Elizabeth Powers, no relation, called Deconstruction Goes Mainstream, which I thought was very, very interesting of this. It's kind of symptomatic of this attempt to provide an intellectual history in a negative vein. So Elizabeth Powers writes, "This French cultural product, which began to occupy a prominent place in American university literature departments in the 1970s, has had the effect of bringing literature departments, especially those of foreign languages, to extinction." Powers suggests that the deconstructionist temperament is widespread in America because the early boomer generation has come to occupy culturally important positions. University kids are becoming woke, she says, which is a culturally apt description of their thinking, and she puts an exclamation mark, of kids who have been raised deconstructively. So one can be raised deconstructively. They can't and they don't read, she argues. The minds of the young protesters are virginal, without depth, without empathy for differences of point of view. They have become more cynical than even the most hardened criminal when it comes to the values of Western civilization. I want to mention, before we start speaking to Avital, this previous version or iteration of the culture wars, right? I guess we're kind of used to thinking about the culture wars now, but they were raging in the 90s and the late 80s and 90s as well. And I guess one of the most famous examples of this is the attempted cancellation of Jacques Derrida, who was awarded an honorary doctorate at Cambridge University in May 1992. And he did get the award. He was awarded it despite protests. People were wearing black armbands in mourning for the status of truth and reason. And there was a letter published in the Times of London, signed by Barry Smith, who is the editor of The Monist, and Quine, and all of these great analytic philosophers. And they argued that Derrida's work, quote, does not meet accepted standards of clarity and rigor. They criticized his, quote, semi-intelligible attacks upon the value of reason, truth, and scholarship. Yeah. So, this is deconstruction, as we are popularly supposed to understand.
Yeah, and one reason we thought it would be great to speak to you, Avital, as you do in your most recent book, Complaint, address these themes in a chapter that's called The Trouble with Deconstruction. Now, you tell us in the book that the title is an allusion to this Hitchcock movie, The Trouble with Harry, in which there's this dead body of this fellow named Harry that everybody's trying to figure out, on one hand, who's to blame for him being dead. So it's sort of a blame question. And then on the other hand, you know, what to do with it, how to deal with this body. So deconstruction is this body, you know, that sort of we have to contend with. But the other connection you make to is the film Rope, also by Hitchcock, which is perhaps a perfect blame theory narrative, because we have a professor played by Jimmy Stewart who essentially imparts this kind of Nietzschean theory to his students, which prompts them to commit murder. So, you know, so you have, you know, these references, and then, you know, you remark on, I think you say something about an entire bureau of complaint built up around the figure of Derrida, who is your teacher and friend. So, you know, one question perhaps is, how does deconstruction itself prompt us to think about these types of narratives, about the question of blame, about these attempts to blame, and, you know, about complaint as you discuss it, about the complaints that are lodged against it.
Thank you. What a pleasant way to start a conversation through Twitterature and other questionable sources, but I'm here. I come as a friend, and I'd love to engage you. I don't want to seem in any way defensive or arrogant. I actually am always itching for a good fight, so don't mess with me too much, because I do like to take it on, to engage, to get in the fight cage and duke it out. This would be a response that Heidegger would repel, because he says polemics has nothing to do with thinking. And polemics, which comes from polemos, polemology, the Greek word for war, is not a way to conduct oneself when one is trying to engage, consider, walk through and trek through the deserts that, according to Nietzsche, are growing, the Wüste wächst, the desert grows, and it's encroaching on us and invading us in a way that Nietzsche has kind of outlined for us. So, polemics. It's hard to avoid it because philosophy and its history and blaming and blameworthy behaviors and rhetorics loves to fight it out and is very parasitical in its transferential attacks. Everyone wants to snuff out the predecessor instead of thanking and so on and so forth. So there is a real fight attitude that of all people, and Dasein's, Heidegger rigorously opposes. He makes a distinction between philosophy, which is an academic discipline, perfectly laudable and hardworking and capable of accumulating great cognitive troves of insight, but it's not thinking. So for Heidegger, thinking is not a game, and he's trying to put Nietzsche in rehab because Nietzsche was the poster boy for Nazi. Well, his sister was a pernicious Nazi and a DJ of his work, Nietzsche. And Heidegger, in what is called thinking, is trying to resuscitate or create a version of Nietzsche and himself that would be denazified. I could show this, but the point being that, so Nietzsche was canceled right after the war. The point is that Nietzsche is not a game that can be called off. I would say the same of Derrida. You can't call him off. There's something that provokes and invites these consistent and repetitive smackdowns. And that, as symptomatologists trained by Nietzsche and in Nietzsche and with the deconstructionists, even though they, by the way, disavow the name deconstruction, it's fraught, it's contaminated, it's full of negativizing energies that you don't want around you. The only one who stuck with it really is Lacour Labarthe, a great philosopher of music and history. And he stuck with it because it's such a persecutable naming. People get allergic very quickly to deconstruction, unless, scandalously, you're a scumbag like Steve Bannon, that who actually said, "We are deconstructing the government." I'm like, thanks. But you know, Derrida said, by the way, let us honor the space in which we find ourselves in the cage. Derrida said that there must be a program in Nietzsche, in Marx, and in Hegel that allows for right-wing appropriations and desecrations. There must be, so he's not someone who, having traversed the very complex and welcome interventions of Freud, who became more and more pessimistic about our ability not to destroy one another. Freud said that in order to stop our nonsense and tearing at one another, we would have to move from primary narcissism to identification with the other. And he wasn't sure anymore if we as a, let's say, human morph, or Dasein, not his word, would be able to make that move from narcissistic self-enclosure to a kind of tearing open, a wounding toward the other whom we might not recognize, identify with, know, or understand. So non-understanding is something that there's very little tolerance for, as your quotes indicated. Mm-hmm. And yet, maybe I could just quickly take us on a shuttle to the German Romantics, Friedrich Schlegel, who wrote a very important essay called Über die Unverständlichkeit. So I say it in German with some irony because it's called On Unintelligibility. And there's a real big allergy to unintelligibility. I don't know if any of you were born when George Bush was president and he was, kept on saying, "Read my lips," which was a kind of slogan of extreme clarity. So those who speak with clarity are usually brutes. Life is complex, it's messy, I don't have to tell you that, just I'm sure you know that. It can't be totalized, it can't be understood very often. So when Friedrich Schlegel wrote one of, I guess it's the first pushback on theory bashing, on unintelligibility, he was prompted by the following. He thought he was really in trouble and about to be jailed, because even the king said, "What is this screed? It's unintelligible. It must be one of the Schlegel brothers. Get him for me." So Schlegel was really freaking out, and he wrote to his great friend, the philosopher Fichte, who is very underappreciated. Thank God, because I want to go there myself and check out that term. But Friedrich said, "Listen, you have to write something that includes me in an exalting way so that the king lays off me, because he thinks I'm unintelligible." So Fichte showed up, he stepped up, he showed what friendship was. By the way, this is what friends do. Foucault and Deleuze did it for each other. One of them would say, "This century will be known as the Deleuze century," and the other, you know, would make sure that Foucault was tagged eternally. anyway, back to the German Romantics. So Fichte said, okay, I'll do it. Fichte wrote a great essay in which he said the three great events of the 18th century are Goethe's, well, he started with the French Revolution, Czech, Goethe's Bildungsroman, so Wilhelm Meister, and my friend Friedrich Schiller, Schlegel's work. I'm writing a thing called Schiller the Killer, so that's how Schiller got in there. So then everyone thought, wow, French Revolution, Goethe, and then Schlegel, okay, we'll take it. And they kind of, that politically loosened the vice around him. Then Fichte wrote a private letter to Schlegel, and he said, listen, I did you the favor out of friendship, but I don't understand an effing, this is my translation, an effing word that you write. I just don't get it. And Schlegel said, that is the sign of genuine friendship, when you don't understand the other, when you don't presume to appropriate the other, but the other remains inappropriable, mystifying, and requiring infinite translation and translatability. So you don't presume to be able to annex the other narcissistically or to say, he really gets me. No, he doesn't. That's a friend who's there without getting you, without seizing, or the word for seizing in German is Begriff, so begreifen, the concept. Without having a concept, I have no concept what you're about. So Schlegel wrote back to Fichte and he said, that's friendship. When the other slips away, remains rigorously unintelligible, and yet you show up for that which you don't understand in the other. The pretend desire, and this goes together, for some sort of mystified intelligibility is in itself questionable. And as those of us who are trained, and we're all trained by Nietzsche on some level of consciousness, we're symptomatologists. Like, what is the anxiety about unintelligibility, by the way? Could you imagine, besides stupid unintelligibility, like Trump or something, you know, not talking that, I'm talking rigorous unintelligibility. It would stop wars. That's a very, I'm practicing right now with you, extreme hermeneutic sports, fast tracking and blowing up cognitive bridges, I apologize. But we as symptomatologists, meaning we're looking at symptoms, and as Freudians, Freud always asked, who are the secret beneficiaries, let's say, of stupidity? Who benefits? Who plays stupid and gets away with a lot of shit because they pretend they're stupid? Again, Bush started that in recent history, American history, that trend of reading a book upside down and, you know, whatever idiotic pose he could strike. It allowed for a lot of underhanded behaviors.
Can I ask you about, we've been hearing about friends, something that came up reading through your work, but just thinking about these issues in general, is the figure of the disciple. And I have to relay this anecdote that you tell in Complaints, where you yourself are accused by Derrida of being the trouble of deconstruction, or of being the number one enemy of deconstruction. So I thought of this question of discipleship. I mean, you brought up Freud, his problem of trying to find a successor. We know what went with Jung. Then we also have these narratives of the thinker who is somehow betrayed by the disciple. I don't know, Marxism was fine until Lenin somehow, you know, put it on the wrong track. These kind of stories. So I'm interested in how that You know, and you brought up before the sort of Oedipal relations within philosophy, within thought, but, you know, this figure of the disciple, as, you know, someone who I took that passage to be dramatizing your own potential occupation of that role of the kind of the disciple who is somehow, you know, being accused of betrayal or of having, you know, set things on the wrong course. So I was curious how that...
You added that.
Yeah. Okay, I apologize.
Barry does just call me the number one. But I think we were duking it out over something. And right now I'm having a very symptomatic lapse. I don't remember why we were fighting, which was a sign of great friendship and intimacy when you can go toe-to-toe with your great teacher. And a lot of these questions are questions of transferential energies, velocities, the libidinization of the other, and also meaning your investment in the other and how you reflect yourself in the other. Away. But what I wanted to say also is something that Nietzsche found or discovered, which is the trope of ressentiment, resentment, and how that moves history and histories and relationships. And we're in an era of grievance, ressentiment, low oil, death drive that is anything but thankful for the other and their craziness and lunacy and inexplicable syntax of being. So I would, with blame, first of all, it's very primitive to blame, right? To lay blame, but it's also a defensive maneuver where if you could blame someone or something or find the origin of what hurts, that would be quite a releasing discovery, right? To be able to place the blame, usually away from oneself as well. So these, I'm trying to bring together also the parasitical urge that I've experienced as a teacher and as a pupil, where you want their place. It's a big honor to, well, as Freud said about one of his patients, the famous Wolfman. The Wolfman had a dream in which he, unless it was the Ratman, my favorite, in which he shat on Freud's head. And Freud said, this is good, because we know that excrement is the first gift. The little child is so excited to have produced something that it wants to offer its shit, the way people offer their papers and all that, I'm sure, to the editors. Look at my caca. I'm so proud of it. I made it. And so Freud, being Freud, understood that they were making progress in the analysis. So how many times have I been shat on? Let me count the ways, you know. But in any case, moving on.
Can I jump in?
Yes,
push
jump
on this,
in.
This, because I had a question that was to do with, like, resentment, ressentiment.
Oh,
and,
good.
You know, I was speaking to my friend Daniel, who's also a writer and an editor, and I was telling him about this event. And he said the reason why people hate deconstruction or they're angry with deconstruction is because of its jouissance, because it's playful, because it's explicitly about, you know, in many ways, like playing with words and kind of demonstrating and performing a kind of enjoyment, right? Whether it's of the other and this kind of openness and these questions of like ambivalence and ambiguity and everything that's kind of being shut down by a kind of bureaucratic imposition of identity. And you know, I studied philosophy.
Wait, can I have Daniel's phone number?
Sure. He's quite sexy, actually. He's like, or you wouldn't, but you
that,
know,
no, the language is all I need at this time.
But anyway, so you know, he was suggesting, and I kind of saw his point, that basically, you know, one of the problems with people who are playful and naughty and ambiguous and you know, funny, and is that their energy is like very irritating. Like there's something very irritating about people enjoying themselves, right? Especially if you...
I'm really enjoying myself, by the way.
But you know, if you're feeling bad and you see people who are like laughing, right? You know, that there's something kind of, you know, defensive. I'm not saying I feel like this. I'm not like particularly, I do sometimes, but you know, everybody does, right? Like. This kind of sheer performance of exuberance and energy is something that is often like felt as an attack. It's kind of alienating. And maybe there's something playful in deconstruction that in a kind of age of sort of neo-moral seriousness and a bureaucratic lockdown that is just anathema to that.
Business values.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Like corporate business bureaucratic
sure.
lockdown, right?
I have so much to say. It is French. And
they're very
naughty. There's a special section in hell for the French because of their plenty of tax, because of something that. But also, it's true that the what Roland Barthes called the pleasure of textuality. But also, if you were to, and this has everything to do with Hamlet and Freud. What is a pun? And never point a loaded pun at a friend. Way. You'll note, if we had time to go into a genealogy of paronomasia or punning or slippery signifiers, it's always related to anality
mm-hmm.
and a kind of anal openness to the world, which is shitty. It's not acceptable. There's something outrageous about it. And also the pretenses of truth and Western values that aren't even interrogated or whose premises are left unquestioned is such a hypocritical right-wing tendency that it would take me a while perhaps to unfold some of these edges with you and perhaps to convince you. I have to open a credit account with you. Because we don't have that much time. I do want to say something, though, about some of the things that are being said, which is perhaps, and Derrida at one point smacking me around a bit, Nietzsche writes about the noble traitor. Nietzsche loved Brutus. And he says that Shakespeare didn't care for that whiny little bitch Hamlet. Shakespeare loved Brutus, as does Nietzsche, and other betrayers, because it takes so much to detach from your mentor. But these are noble traitors, not little pissants who go after you, make shit up, and try to harm you and are bloated with resentment. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about someone, and this happened to Nietzsche when he split off many times from Wagner. He kept on writing Nietzsche versus Wagner, the case of Wagner, so on and so forth. But then Nietzsche would get responses saying, I'm so glad you're off that drug, Wagner. And you should move on to Brahms or someone worthy. And Nietzsche goes, whoa, there's a big misunderstanding here. Wagner was a windfall. He's my teacher. I love Wagner. I had to break up with him. Nietzsche would never use this word, but I'm abbreviating shorthand. It was an ethical necessity to get away from this oversized Reichs German that everyone is kind of mesmerized by an anti-Semitic monstrosity. I had to do it because I love him. Not if I hated him, it would have been easy. I could have just sidelined him, forgotten him, but it was the greatest pain, as it must have been for Brutus. So there's something in the transferential turbulence in your relation to a great teacher. When the teacher goes into some sort of overdrive, and it could be an American moralistic overdrive or a self-aggrandizing grandiosity, or something happens when in great pain you have to decide on your greatest warrior solitude. That didn't happen with Derrida, but there were moments where we were at each other's delicate throats. There's no doubt about it. And then finally I asked him, what made you so angry at me once? And he said, yeah, it was a phantasm. You wrote with a kind of abandon that scared me about drugs and ethnocide, and you went through a kind of deviant history of drugs. You even gave it different political protest kinds of values and valuations, for example, in during the Vietnam War, which kind of drug meant you were anti-war, and which, and what about the Germans with their heroin and heroisch and the kinds of drugs that they used to bomb in the Blitzkrieg and so on. He said, but you also kind of indicated a jouissance. You kind of strayed from a sheer analysis, a rigorous analysis that he does offer us in Plato's Pharmacy, when he goes after the ambiguity of certain drugs like the pharmacon, which is a remedy and a destructive drug, and you can't tell which it's going to be and what's going to be the homeopathic values of different kinds of relations to drugs. And then you asked, is there such a thing as a drug-free zone? And what about American addiction behaviors? We're bloated on narcotics in this country. As you know, I don't know why my voice raised, I apologize. So his fantasy was that he would be stopped at customs and not allowed in because of my wild ass kind of punky abandon that would get him in trouble, because he had the sense that without guaranteeing our sense-making machines or unintelligibilities, he would get in trouble for because of the filiation and affiliation for making us into these protest machines. Not all Derridians are troublemakers and always in trouble, and he practically has to bail you out of jail every other, you know, year. But I was a wild card and a wild one. So he said it was terrifying because he thought I would get him in trouble. He was arrested in Prague because they put some drugs in his, and he was such an idiot about drugs, except when he was writing about them brilliantly. He said, who put this sugar, this blow, you know, in my suitcase? He didn't even understand what was going on.
Who did put it in his suitcase?
Well, they did.
Right.
You see, they told him, you are not invited. The great philosophers of Prague who were fired summarily from their positions in the university and so on, they invited him to come and talk to them. And then the Soviet government said, you can't. But he did, and then he got arrested on the way out. you know. But what they underestimated is that Marguerite Derrida, his wife, a psychoanalyst and translator, and a great person altogether, she immediately picked up the phone and called some of his students and friends, like of the name Mitterrand and so on. So they fished him out very quickly, but it was terrifying. And the night he came back, Jean Genet came to visit. He said, "So how did you like it in jail?" And he said on this thing, "Did you blame Avital for denouncing you?" Because I was born in Prague. And Jack said, "I did think of it, because right before I was supposed to go with him, and so was Pierre and his son, and so was someone else, his wife. And right before I switched tickets and I decided to go to the MLA, which is the Modern Language Association." And so he said, "Yeah, wasn't that sneaky?" Just suddenly she diverted. She like said, "Yeah, we're all going to Prague. It's a great idea. Let's do it, even though it's been forbidden." So let me see, is there anything urgent that I wanted to say? I think I'm a little all over the place, but I do want to say one thing only, because deconstruction has been hit with a number of repeated attacks and familiar articulations. And it's one of the things is that it's accused of being destructive, mm-hmm. as you said. And here I would go with Heidegger's distinction between reading Nietzsche, coming from Nietzsche, between devastation and destruction. Because when Nietzsche tries to appropriate himself in Ecce Homo, the kind of autobiographical work that he wrote, in which he criticizes himself severely, he begins by saying, "It's my birthday and I have the right to destroy everything, to bury everything that is destructive, to destroy what is destructive and resentful and poisonous." That's a pledge to the future. When you destroy things, when you get them out of the way, what we nowadays call toxicity, that's all in Nietzsche. Nietzsche called Wagner a toxic Dasein. You know, is Wagner überhaupt ein Mensch? Is Wagner even human? He's a toxic, you know, pile. And so Heidegger points out in his Nietzsche work that devastation is something else. And that's when there is no coming back. There's no pledge to the future. There's no futurity. And that's what we all, even if we've been on the wrong side of history, to say it too quickly, and we've been wrong and wronging the other, we must pull back from acts that are devastating, because there's no coming back from that, and there's no futurity. So they're not wrong. I mean, deconstruction comes from the word Abbau. So it is taking things apart, looking at them, wondering what our premises are, and how did we get here? Why is this a constant and growing slaughterhouse of unjustifiable cruelty and puerility? Yeah, so tell me about your Western values now. I'm listening. I mean, they have to be looked at.
I'm sorry, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm not really understanding how, given the definition of deconstruction, it is compatible to utter from that perspective that there is a wrong side of history. Also, just no matter what we think about perhaps a spiritual devastation of the time in which we live, by any kind of measure that we can observe, the violence and the aggression and the terrible atrocities that you mentioned are smaller than they have ever been in history. And so it seems
are smaller?
To, absolutely. Unless you talk unless you talk about the wrong speech or some other types of emotional aggressions that maybe you were referring to, but this is an incontrovertible fact. So I'm just not really understanding.
I'm just gonna try and summarize your question for the sake of the recording.
I just hear a number of contradictions.
I'm gonna do my best to kind of summarize, and I apologize for being, I don't know, vulgar and shorthand, but for the sake of people listening. So I guess part of what you're saying is this kind of question. I mean, I think Avatar was invoking the idea of the wrong side of history in heavily inverted commas, and she said it was a kind of shortcut. But I mean, this is a phrase that's often used on the British left to impugn your enemies, like you're on the wrong side of history if you don't agree with some progressive cause. But your broader point, perhaps if I can be bold to summarize, was along the lines of, question was really along the lines of this, what has happened to violence? Like, do we still really, I mean, clearly the world is insanely violent and cruel, but the question, the terrain upon which these questions of cruelty are currently playing out are themselves kind of rhetorical in the West in many ways? Was it this kind of idea? Maybe I missed something.
I was referring to actual historical fact. As saying that we live probably in the most peaceful time that humanity has ever lived. And I'm only talking about physical violence right now. So I'm just not really sure what we're referring to.
Okay, the question of human violence, has it diminished to some degree? I mean, I think globally, we can't say this, but I mean, Avatar, please.
I appreciate your sense of indignity, and I'm sure we agree on so many things, but there's no ambiguity about certain judgments that have to be brought to any number of despicable acts. So I'm sure we all agree about that, and also the incalculability of certain kinds of aggression. You know, in Freud, before he went for the death drive, he was writing about the Aggressionstrieb. So aggression is primal. He then substituted and replaced it with the death drive. So our aggression is still something to contend with. It's not something that I would calculate as being greater or lesser. It's the level of atrocity isn't even something that I would be able to measure. I'm interested in interrogating the premises that offer some sort of justification for such devastation. So I'm not sure why, when I was describing the difference between devastation and destruction, your outburst was placed on us, and what you'd like me to address. I'd be very happy to address your complaint and plaint, but I'm not sure I understood.
Can I attempt to interpret? So I wanted to raise an issue as well that goes into the litany of complaints of narratives of blame that have sort of been laid at the feet of deconstruction, also of someone like Nietzsche, who we've been discussing as well, is relativism, and perhaps for Nietzsche would also be nihilism, where you have this interesting problem. You brought up symptomatology, a sort of body of writing that is attempting, is clearly attempting to diagnose nihilism, right, to identify its symptoms, its causes, then becomes associated with nihilism, right? It becomes kind of contaminated with this idea of it, and then is read in those terms. Perhaps there's something similar going on with relativism that, is often one of the things that, if you want to go through the mainstream sort of complaints about deconstruction, I think, relativism and particularly moral relativism, right? We had a question that, had to do with fundamentally moral issues about violence. And so then the question becomes, how do we address these issues when we're on such unstable ground? Doesn't this open us up to a kind of moral chaos, right? So I think this is a frequent question that's raised and has been for quite a long time. So
it's so hard for me to respond to these things that are said in bad faith and without maybe having read some of the works that are very difficult. I avow that. I'm teaching a course right now called Derrida's Greatest Hits, and it includes the hits that are prods, are weaponized kinds of analyses and concerns. And there you go, the spectral incursion. So I've also been thinking a lot about Kant and the way he opened so much up, but he also provoked, I don't know if you know the great writer Kleist. He had a very famous Kantkrise, so a crisis, a nervous breakdown, because Kant opened up the ungrounding, the instabilities with which we live. I mean, anything that mystifies and tells you you have a ground or a leg to or a legacy to stand on is deceiving you. Now, Derrida didn't take your, object away from you. He's looking at what kind of mystical foundations we try to get by on. By the way, Freud said life is too hard. And it's very hard. And we're all struggling in all sorts of ways that are unsayable, maybe latent, maybe we don't know the level of wounding and wars that are being waged internally, externally, if we can locate where the aggression comes from or speaks to us. So I wanted to say that there's a lot of projection, as in all violence, and I'm working also on the addictionary of violence. So the way we're addicted to violence, the way media also, since Plato advocates violence, in a sense, in its very way of inscribing things. There's something also of a life instinct, again, Nietzsche. If you're not violently opposed or upset, that's Paul Celan. Stay upset. Be violent with the way things are. But if you then cover this stuff up with a false transcendental ceiling or some sort of mytheme of groundedness, you're not doing yourselves a favor, and things have to be interrogated for their fragility and the way they break apart and break off. That's why I thought it was worth our time to consider the difference between devastation and destruction, because there are things that need to be destroyed and gotten rid of in very careful, consensual, serious, intellectually committed ways. Not that I put much store in intellectuals, please don't get me wrong. But you can't, I mean, the projection, the level of projection onto Derrida is like as if he relativized
mm-hmm.
all the shit we're hit with. You know, it's almost funny. They also blame deconstruction or Derrida for Nazis, which not only is historically wrong, but because Derrida rode with Heidegger to a certain extent, because Heidegger as a thinker is unbypassable, but he criticized him at every step of the way. And it wasn't a thorough takedown. And that's very difficult, this position of being grateful to a scoundrel, to having to decide that you're going to do the work even if you don't like the flavor or the person and so on and so forth. So those are very delicate decisions that one makes also when choosing a mentor. Some people don't like their mentors, they become tormentors. Some people don't, or some people like them too much, you know, and are blinded. But I think I would love to hear what other people want to know. I come with subtitles and supertitles and footnotes, so I do want to be, despite Schlegel, a little bit intelligible.
I think Nina had a question about media.
Yeah, sure. I mean, maybe just a like a really quick question, and then we can kind of open it up a bit for however long, like Avital fancies. So, I mean, I was rereading your telephone book, which is very interesting, and you know, like Derrida was looking at the postcard, and I think these kind of attempts to look at the way in which particular media shape then not only the form of communication, but how we relate to one another, and you've already brought up the question of narcissism and so on. And the, you know, the telephone book is looking at this particular relationship of the voice, and you know, you talk about Alexander Bell and the invention of the machine, and you know, and I was thinking about the complaint in the age of the email, right? And as someone who's received many, many emails, well, people who've worked with me have received many, many emails of complaint about me, and this is a common experience these days. And there is this kind of thing about, you know, when you work, I used to work for a newspaper, like volunteer, and if you got crazy letters from the general public, right, they would go at the back of a filing cabinet or in the bin, right? You didn't treat them seriously, right? Like, you'd be like, here's another insane letter, right? Let's ignore it. But for some reason, the medium of the email, and even the anonymous email or the anonymous open letter, has this kind of power, and it's something to do in the sense of being a complaint. Like, these complaints are taken seriously. Or like the tweets to the institution are somehow taken seriously. And I just wonder, in the transition from thinking about these different media, like the telephone, which is, you know, okay, at a distance, and the question of presence and the voice is central to thinking about deconstruction, and, you know, whether we're there when we hear somebody, and in a way, like, writing has won. Like, we live in the textual era, do you know what I mean? Like, we're surrounded by signs and text. You know, presence is relatively rare. If we're lucky, we were locked down for years on end. We, you know, it's actually hard to see people in the flesh. It's almost unbearable sometimes. So anyway, I guess I just wondered, I just had this question about the email. What do you think of emails?
Oh my.
It's a very weird question.
You know, I've traveled among media and got stuck on TV for a while, and video, and noted how much policing is done in films and video, and how something is resolved of a criminal imaginaire. So I'm wondering, my question back would be, to what extent is email, as you're describing it, and being hit by it, in certain orifices and ways, to what extent is it part of a mourning disorder?
Oof. Okay.
Because I'm wondering, I'm sketching a spontaneous response, and I would benefit from others' views, but to what extent is it a kind of repression of delay, deferral of the writing that it is, and it demands a very quick repost, right? It would be insulting to have someone wait for a few days. So there's something about it that kind of militates against its writing, let's say, predicament or description. I think email comes off as aggressive because it poses as speech, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about the anonymous nature of some envoi or send-offs is that on the one hand, no one takes responsibility for the ugly complaint
mm-hmm.
that is unsigned. And so it can really overgrow in terms of, is this a broadcast from God? If you have a psychotic moment, who's behind this kind of messaging if it's not signed by a mortal, recognizable
mm-hmm.
hand? Or in the sense of the great writer Blanchot, every writing wants to kick away the signature and become a rumor, a murmur, and just disseminate without being held back by a so-called author. So that would be the dream of all writing, is just to let it go into a Heideggerian Gewaltenheit or thrownness of being, just send it off and let it happen. My friend, the techno philosopher, techno scientific philosopher, his name is Friedrich Kittler, rhymes with the other one, said that every text is a hand grenade. You just pull that thing and send it off and let it blow up. But you don't, so to what extent are missives and missiles co-piloting certain kinds of arrivals, non-arrivals? By the way, deconstruction was always DOA, dead on arrival, which gives it authority. Those who are not with us, or the undead, are very powerful, have a powerful hold on us, but that would open another dossier. So the question is, I would start, I don't know what to do with the overwhelming attack emails, meaning just getting them is exhausting, right? So I don't know where to start analyzing it, except in a kind of repression of writing as writing.
What a great answer.
Thanks.
Oh, I understand you. Okay.